Okay, ladies and gentlemen, we're reconvening for item 9. Since we are now starting item 9, I will close the speaker cards at this time. So if you had a speaker card, please provide it right now for this item 9, because after the commencement of item 9, I will not accept additional speaker cards for this particular topic. So, Mr. Harris, would you please introduce the item?
So, before I introduce the item, a couple of things. I want to mention that State Board Division of Drinking Water staff, Kurt Souza, is with us today, so that in the event you have any questions regarding the drinking water aspects of this, he's here to answer your questions. Also, after I do the introduction, Ms. Austin has some procedural issues she needs to go over. So item 9 is an amendment of waste discharge requirements, the National Pollutant Discharge Elimination System permit number CA0048143 for the City of Santa Barbara, El Estero Wastewater Treatment Facility Order number R3-2010-0011. Dr. Peter Van Lagen is the staff person who will give a brief overview of the amendment to the NPDES permit for the City of Santa Barbara Wastewater Treatment Plant and Charles E. Meyer Desalinization Facility. This amendment is to facilitate the city in its efforts to start up the desalinization facility during the drought emergency in compliance with the draft State Water Board Desalinization Policy Amendment to the California Ocean Plan. At this time, I'll turn it over to Ms. Austin.
Thank you, and I just wanted to draw the board's attention to a handout that was placed in front of you during the break. This is a copy of a notice of public hearing for proposed increases in the City of Santa Barbara water rates. Mr. Young received this last week. Is that correct, Mr. Young?
Could you repeat that?
Because the public notice.
Mr. Robertson was asking me something. It's hard for me to do.
The public notice that you have.
Did you want me to discuss this flyer?
I just wanted you to confirm you received this last week. Is that correct?
I'm a resident of the City of Santa Barbara, and I drink the city's water. I may be drinking the city's desal water if that comes to pass. And I received in the mail a notice of public hearing involving potential water rate increases. And this is a notice of a public hearing, and in the back of this was a two-page front and side flyer, and there was on the back part of this, the City of Santa Barbara drought frequently asked questions, and in here there are some comments, questions and comments made about the desal plant. So I thought because it touches on the desal plant and because I read it, that I brought it to council's attention and let them make the decision as to whether this should be part of the record, and they said yes, definitely. So that's where this came from.
Thank you. And so just to confirm, you received that last week?
It may be before last week. I may have gotten it a couple of weeks ago, and it sat on my kitchen table, and I just stared at it after I read it, not knowing what to do with it and thinking it might be something I might want to read as I was actually reading the staff materials.
Okay.
So it's been a couple of weeks.
So just for our record, we are making this part of the record consistent with government code 11430.50. Ms. Olson has additional copies of this document if there are folks in the audience who would like to review this. Also for our record today, this is with respect to our supplemental that was provided to you this week. Just mentioning there was an email from Joe Monaco. It's dated December 17th. It's written to Megan Powers, and it concerns the permitted capacity of the plant. And just to clarify for our record that this is part of the record. So those are my procedural notes, and feel free to.
And also for the record, is Council Oaken?
Oh,
still?
No, thank
yes.
you.
Yes, she is on the phone.
Okay.
Okay, thank you.
And Mr. Chair? Would this be the time for any ex-party contacts to be disclosed?
There shouldn't be any ex-party, right?
So
yep.
Just to be safe, I have not spoken to anybody about this flyer, but I did want to say that a number of months ago, I did have a discussion with Rebecca Bjork, who we're probably going to hear from today. It really had very little to do with DCEL and mostly had to do with seeing what the city could do in terms of increasing its use of recycled wastewater. And I think at the time the DCEL issue may not have been agendized. We really didn't get into it at all, but I did have that discussion. Separate from that contact, maybe about a week ago, I gave Mike Jordan a call, mainly to wish him a belated Happy New Year and to tell him, you know, I was going to miss him being on the water board. And he had mentioned something about, you know, that he would be appearing today and speaking on behalf of the city. And we just had a very brief chat about CEQA and what this process looked like. And it was a very general discussion. I didn't learn anything from Mr. Jordan that persuades me one way or the other about this. Sorry, Mike. but there really was very little exchanged about this in particular. And it was really a call that I made just to say hello to him. So I just wanted that to come out.
Any other comment before we proceed? So, Mr. Harris?
I have nothing further, Mr. Chair.
Okay. So we're ready for the staff presentation.
Chair Wolf, members of the board. I'm Peter Von Langen, Central Coast Water Board staff, and I'll be giving this presentation on item 9 regarding the Charles E. Meyer Desalination Facility and El Estero Wastewater Treatment Plant Permit Amendment. Along with me is a California Sea Grant fellow working with the State Water Board, Dr. Megan Powers. So the big question is, why are we here today? And it's to propose an amendment to the NPDES permit for the Charles E. Meyer Desalination Facility. The NPDES permit lacks the necessary finding from the California Water Code called Section 13142.5B. This amendment finds and clarifies that the facility is considered existing under this Water Code section. A brief overview of the timeline of the NPDES permits for this facility is following, and the city can also address this in their presentation following. The desalination facility was first permitted, constructed, and operated in the early 1990s. The facility was put into a long-term storage once rains occurred in 1992 or so, and the storage was put after that in 1996 as part of the city's long-term water supply plan. There's been several renewals since the permit for the desalination facility was first done in 1991. There's been about 4 renewals, and the latest was a 2010 permit renewal of the El Estero wastewater plant that included the desalination facility discharge in it. The city, again, wants to reactivate this desalination facility due to the unprecedented drought that we're now occurring in California. A brief schematic of the desalination facility and wastewater treatment plant locations on the coast east of Stearns Wharf and Santa Barbara Harbor. The desalination facility is just across the street from the El Estero wastewater treatment plant, and these facilities share a discharge outfall approximately 1.65 miles offshore in the Pacific Ocean in the Santa Barbara Channel, where it discharges in about 70 feet of water through a multi-port diffuser with 60 diffuser ports. The intake for the desalination facility is approximately half a mile offshore in about 30 feet of water. And this intake pipe used to be the former discharge pipe of the wastewater treatment plant. We're dealing today with the intake of the desalination facility because there are impacts to the marine environment from intakes of seawater, industrial uses of seawater. One of the main impacts is called impingement, whereby larger fish are trapped against screens if the velocity of the intake is great, and so that the fish can't swim away and can be trapped and die. Another impact is entrainment, whereby smaller larvae that can fit through the slot size of the screens get entrained and pass through the industrial process and killed in that process. other impacts in the marine environment occurring from ocean intakes are that the construction-related impacts from building pipes or building subsea floor intake systems. You can disturb sandy floor habitat, which is less biodiverse and less organisms than, say, a rocky reef habitat where kelp can thrive with all the biodiversity associated with the kelp forest. So the impacts can disrupt the breeding grounds, foraging grounds, and vegetation during these construction impacts. The specific Water Code section 13142.5b that we're addressing today, that is the permit amendment, is that for each new or expanded industrial facility, several measures need to be looked at to minimize mortality and intake of marine life. It's the best combination of these measures, meaning the site, design, technology, and mitigation have to be looked at as a whole to look at the best overall intake for a facility using industrial seawater. This amendment provides a finding based on the information that was available back when the facility, the desalination facility, was first constructed in the early 1990s. I'll go over the four types of measures again, the site design, technology, and mitigation that was used in this draft amendment to the NPDES permit. First, the site was chosen adjacent to the El Estero wastewater facility because it was decided that it was the best to minimize intake and mortality in marine life because they used the existing infrastructure of the outfall and intake pipes. This limited environmental impacts from constructing new pipes elsewhere. These intake and outfall pipes are located in sandy marine habitat, which is less, again, biodiverse and less sensitive compared to rocky reef structures where some of the other sites were looked at by the city. They also chose a site because the existing water distribution system was near El Estero, so it made it easier to distribute potable water after desalination throughout the area and region. A brief overview of the designs that were looked at for this facility were that the co-location with the El Estero wastewater treatment plant again allowed the use of the existing intake and outfall structures. It allowed the brine, which is denser than seawater, to be mixed with fresh water from the wastewater plant and more easily dispersed and diluted in the ocean outfall. The outfall was also constructed with a 60-port diffuser system to increase the dispersion of the brine and wastewater effluent to make for rapid mixing. And finally, the intake structure was designed in a way to have a very slow intake of 0.1 feet per second, which would virtually eliminate impingement from the ocean environment. The technology was chosen in the early 1990s based on the feasibility and hydrologic studies of doing subsurface intakes offshore of East Beach. They found that there wasn't enough water from the multi-beach wells to get enough water for the needs of the city, and at that point, the needs of Goleta and Montecito as well. The technology used of commingling the brine with the diffusers as an outfall was another aspect looked at to consider this best technology at the time. And again, the low-velocity screen intake system was the best technology to minimize mortality in marine life. There was no mitigation proposed in the early 1990s. The impingement effects were considered insignificant with the low-velocity screen intakes, and the unavoidable entrainment impacts were also considered insignificant due to the relative high productivity of the area, and there would be no impact discernible on plankton populations. The city is volunteering to do the following environmental projects with this amendment today. They're proposing to construct wedge wire screens on the intake, which will eliminate impingement and have some reduction on entrainment. This is considered a higher, newer technology than the existing screens that are on the facility now. The city is also volunteering to spend $500,000 for the Devereux Slough project, about 10 miles west of the facility on the west part of the UCSB campus. It's important local habitat for intertidal species and estuarine species, and there's a nexus with flowing into the ocean during winter months. They're also proposing to do a study by 2017 to assess the feasibility of subsurface intakes and potable reuse by the city. And they're going to present this at a future regional board meeting by 2017. So in conclusion, there should have been a 13142.5B finding in the existing permits, but there wasn't one. The facility would be considered existing per this finding, and the amendment is to find that this finding would have been done back in 1990 and 91 when the facility was first built and permitted. And finally, the city volunteers beneficial environmental projects with this amendment. So a recommendation is to adopt the NPDES order today, the amendment, and the supplemental sheets changes.
Thank you for this presentation. And because this topic is fairly technical, what we will do is have our board ask questions after the presentation. So in this instance, presentation from staff, then when we'll have presentation from the city, and then public comments, because I think it will allow us to be a little bit more specific and when things are fresh in our mind. So at this time, look on my left here, do we have questions? Mr. Delgado?
Thank you. How much money approximately will the city invest to reopen this facility? 10 million, 20 million?
I believe it's somewhere in the 20 million, but the city would be better to answer that question.
No, that's fine, just ballpark. What's the point of assessing subsurface intake alternatives by 2017, let's say, your last slide, if there's already been significant financing, 20 million or whatever it is, put into reopening the facility with before that happened, before 2017?
That's another city. I believe the city should answer that question.
Okay, I'll wait on that so we don't. So the only thing I have left to ask is, it's said in one of your slides and in our staff report that as of the 1990s, it wasn't expected that there would be an impact, significant impact to plankton communities or other marine life from entrainment. Has it been confirmed that that is still true, you know, some 20 years later?
As a staff, I would assess that the entrainment levels are relatively small. When you look at a volumetric approach, when you compare a facility like this to, say, a large power plant such as Diablo Canyon that takes 2.4 billion gallons a day, and all the scientific studies that have been done there over decades still cannot discern an environmental impact from these types of studies. So it'd be very difficult to find any impact from a small desal facility based on an entrainment study. There's been one done up in Santa Cruz for a pilot project that was for the Santa Cruz proposed desalination project, and this was done by Tenera with the oversight of a technical work group. And the findings of that year-long study showed minimal to non-detectable, or non-detectable on the environmental side, but you could see minimal effects, de minimis effects from entrainment of the larvae.
Okay, and I understand that impingement is not significant because of the low velocity intake. But then later you mentioned that there would be wire screens put up to reduce impingement. Why is it necessary if there's not a lot to begin with?
These wire screens are looked at as best available technology for power plant intakes from the 316B rules of the Clean Water Act. And it is proposed in the state board desalination policy to require wedge wire screens if an ocean subsurface intake is not feasible.
So that's a new requirement that is not required here, but their proposal is to do it anyway.
The city is volunteering to do it, yes.
Okay. Thank you. Thank you, Chair.
Mr. Johnston.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
So let's see, I have a few questions. I've heard several different numbers tossed around as far as the acre feet per year capacity of the plant. I heard a 10,000 acre foot annual acre foot capacity as the original studies were done on, a 7,500, which I think is what it's permitted for. I'm reading the city's flyer. It says that they're planning on opening it at 3,125, I think, and potentially expanding it later to 7,500. Can you kind of explain how those numbers fit together?
Well, originally the facility was permitted for the up to 10,000 acre foot back in the early 1990s. And I think Megan Powers may be able to explain this better, or the city's consultants can get into the details of that. Probably the city would be a better source.
Because I see in their thing that they say it's permitted for 7,500, and your understanding is it's permitted for 10,000?
There was different permits over the years, but I believe originally the permit was 7,500 acre feet, and then it was expanded to 10,000 acre feet in the early 1990s. But I think the city should answer that question for the details.
Okay, but from our perspective, is it currently permitted for 10,000?
Yeah, our discharge of the brine is up to 12.5 MGD, and if you do the math with that to calculate it to acre feet, it turns out to be the 10,000 acre feet a year.
Okay, so our permitting was based on the amount of discharge rather than on the amount of water produced, clean water produced.
Yes, our NPDES permits have the discharge volume in there, and we have 12.5 million gallons a day of brine, and then if you double that more or less to get the total volume that's taken in by the intake, half of that being made as reverse osmosis water and the other half being discharged, it back calculates to about 10,000 acre feet a year.
Okay, and is that based on, I know that RO systems are becoming dramatically more efficient. Is that based on 90s technology or current technology? That concept of doubling the discharge to get the intake.
That's just a good rule of thumb.
Okay.
To have.
So when we initially permitted this, were we? I mean, I'm trying to. Somebody told me that I forget if it was in the briefing or what, that we didn't issue a 13142(5)(b) or whatever it is initially, because at the time those were really only being issued for power plants, and I guess until somebody sued around one in the mid 2000s, they weren't really looked at for desal plants. Is that kind of more or less true?
Yeah, that's a pretty good assessment.
So when we initially permitted it, were we permitting the intake as well as the discharge? I see our permit looking at siting, and I see talking about, you know, siting and such. But was our permit focused just on the discharge, or was it equally focused on the intake?
The intake was included in the permits as being mentioned and so on, and the environmental documents that were looked at back then, probably by staff at the time that did these permits, would have considered the intakes, but I don't know if they would have, well, they didn't put the finding in the permit because that wasn't the normal procedure back then. Every section of water code isn't usually spelled out in an NPDES permit.
So initially, certainly the environmental impact documents talked about the intake as well as the discharge, because those documents are used for a variety of permitting, not just our permits.
Correct.
But I guess my question is, did our staff consider the intake, or were they really looking at the outfall when they gave the initial permit?
I would venture that since it was mentioned in the permit, the original permits about the intake and shown on the diagrams and so on, that it was considered.
Okay. Now, I see that there was the initial environmental documents. The reference I've seen in the staff reports is
that back in 91, infiltration galleries or beach wells were not considered practical because they didn't have the ability, given the geology, to generate the amount of water they needed. Has that changed? Has that technology changed? I mean, is that, would that still be the case, or did it really not get a close look, or what's the deal on that?
There are now examples of infiltration galleries at the scale that could potentially supply the water to this size desalination facility if the geology was suitable for that type of technology.
But from the reading the staff reports, apparently the assertion was made at the time that the geology wouldn't accommodate those kind of infiltration galleries. So is that old technology? Or do we really know?
The infiltration gallery was a newer type of technology.
Okay.
They looked at the old beach wells, which was a more standard technology back then, but with the beach wells, they couldn't get enough water through the beach wells for the size that they were proposing to make for the desalination facility.
For my information, is an infiltration gallery something that they put sub-sea floor as opposed to on the beach?
Yes, it goes out under the seafloor and sucks through the sand layer above it.
Okay. I think you may have answered this for Mr. Delgado. I'm not sure, but if they were currently in a situation where it was were not feasible to use under seafloor intake, would the entrainment and infiltration protections provided by the existing design plus the modifications that the city proposes to make meet our current standards?
Currently, yes. And it depends on what goes on with the state board desal policy down the road.
So we don't know if the state board is going to impose a higher standard or if they're discussing a higher standard. I mean, I understand that they're discussing where feasible under seafloor intake, and that's the big question that the city's looking at. But where that's not feasible, is the state board? Do we know if the state board is looking at a higher standard than would be than is going to be applied to this intake?
So I just want to remind the board, we do have state board staff here, so if you want to, you can direct your questions to Mr. Wiles or
I would love
Whitney.
That, and I believe so would you.
Thank you.
Good morning, Mr. Johnson, Chair Wolf, and board members. I'm Phil Wiles. I'm an assistant chief counsel with the State Water Board, and I advise the state board on water quality issues. Just to be clear, I'm not acting as your attorney here. You have two very capable attorneys who are advising you, Tamron Austin and Lori Oaken, on the telephone. And with me is Victoria Whitney. She's the, as you heard, the deputy director for Division of Water Quality. We are both working with the state board as it develops its ocean plan amendment for desalination facilities. So I can answer your question specifically, Mr. Johnson, which is that the ocean plan amendment, which has not yet been adopted by the state board, does contemplate for new facilities, certainly, that there would be a fairly thorough level of analysis to ensure that that the combination, as Dr. von Langen explained, of site and design and technology and mitigation is the best available feasible combination for new facilities. I don't think it's possible to say whether assuming subsurface for this Santa Barbara facility is determined not to be feasible, whether the rest of the site and design and mitigation and technology would or would not actually meet what the state board is ultimately going to adopt, because it anticipates a process to evaluate all of those factors and to evaluate whether or not as a new facility is proposed, whether or not it would actually meet current standards for site design, technology, and mitigation. So it's a long answer, but I think the bottom line is we would not be able to tell without doing a thorough analysis whether this facility would meet the current standards for a new facility under under the proposed ocean plan amendment.
Okay, and finally, and I think this is back to you, Doctor, is the city's talking about reopening it at 3,125 acre feet per year. I'm hearing from you that our standard, that our permitting is based on how many million gallons of brine they put out. So I'm assuming that even if they, that if they opened it at that level, which is a lower level than they operated it at decades ago, and later expanded it to 7,500 or 10,000 or whatever, that as long as it were within the permitted range of gallonage, that we would not consider that an expansion. Is that correct?
Yes, that's my understanding.
Have you got something different?
No, I just wanted to point out that maybe it would be useful for the board for me to put this in context in terms of how this action relates to the Ocean Plan Amendment generally and why this is before the regional board now, and if you'd like me to do that, I'd be happy to. But the short answer is the Ocean Plan Amendment does contain a proposed definition for an expanded facility, and under a circumstance where the facility is originally approved, permitted, and the original determination under this Water Code Section 13142.5B anticipates this future expansion, in that circumstance, there would be no further need to go back and look at whether that future expansion triggers a new determination under 13142.5B.
And the order that the State Board is contemplating similarly measures desal plants by their brine discharge, is that correct?
Well, specifically, and maybe I should just take a moment, if you don't mind, and explain the general context, because we're kind of hitting on individual points throughout.
Sure, and then I'll give up the microphone here.
So, first of all, what's really critical here, both for the State Board and its Ocean Plan Amendment, and the reason this issue is before you, is because the Water Code section that we're talking about, 13142.5B, is frankly unique in terms of the statutes that the water boards administer under the Port of Cologne Act. The terms of that section, first of all, there's not a clear statement that we actually are supposed to issue permits for intakes. There's a limitation that it applies only to new or expanded coastal power plants or other industrial installations that use seawater for cooling, heating, or industrial processing. So the key is it's for new or expanded. This board is used to having continuing jurisdiction over any type of discharge of waste that you might have authorized in the past, and is used to being able to I'll pause for a moment. I think we're trying to keep Lori Oaken on the phone here. Well, she's heard this before. Maybe I'll continue and we'll just try to reconnect her. any other discharge of waste, and this is, you know, we're talking here primarily about the intake of seawater, but a discharge of waste, the legislature has granted to the regional board continuing authority to oversee and to regulate that discharge of waste. And as technology evolves, as our thinking about the impacts of those discharges of waste evolve, this regional board has clear authority to continue to ratchet down, continue to require new technologies to be applied to those existing discharges of waste, and even frankly to say that we used to let you discharge waste here, and now we're not going to anymore, and you need to take the expense and the time to find another way to take care of your wastewater issues. 13142.5B is different. It's for new or expanded facilities. You can look at it, if you will, as the legislature decided that we get one bite at the apple, and it's when a proposal comes forward for either a new facility or an expansion of a facility. And because it's so key that it has those terms, the proposed State Board Ocean Plan Amendment has proposed definitions for those terms, and that's, you know, essentially the genesis of why we're here. The City of Santa Barbara, at the State Board hearing in the summer, objected to the definitions that we were proposing, and so let me read to you what that main definition is, so you get a sense of it. We create a distinction between essentially a new or an existing facility in the proposed amendment. We also have a definition for expanded facilities, which I can mention if you'd like, but we're really, I think, in this proceeding talking about new versus existing. And essentially every facility would be either new or existing, and if it's not existing, it's new. The proposed definition says that, in part, an existing facility does not include a facility for which permits and approvals were issued and construction commenced after the effective date of this water code section, if the Regional Water Board did not make a determination under this water code section. And so what we're essentially trying to do, the proposal is to say that if a facility was permitted, was constructed, but these factors were not considered at the time, then we're not going to treat it as an existing facility. We will instead treat it as a new facility and require that analysis be done, even though the facility has already been constructed, may in fact be operating at this time. I should point out that this is not a final definition. The State Board may well change it. But what happened in summer of 2014 is the city stood up and objected to this and said, well, wait a minute, we have the Charles E. Meyer facility. It was permitted. It has been constructed. It's been in a standby mode. And they'll tell you more about this. And what this proposed definition would do is it would create a lot of uncertainty about whether or not we can reactivate this facility in this time of drought. And the State Board members at the hearing, I think, were somewhat sympathetic to that concern, certainly the drought concern, and asked its staff, myself and Victoria and her staff, to see if we couldn't reach a resolution with the city that would both preserve the proposed language in the Ocean Plan Amendment, but also create certainty for the City of Santa Barbara in terms of its plans to reactivate the facility in the time of drought. We talked to the city, and frankly, the best we could come up with, what we thought at a staff level was the most equitable approach, was to go back and look at the record of all of the permits and the CEQA documentation and whatever was available to the Regional Water Board back in the early 90s, and determine whether or not the regional board could today say that the information that was available back in the 90s, using the lens of what was the best available feasible site design mitigation and technology, whether at the time it met the 13142.5B determination. I will tell you, I'll be the first to admit this is unusual, that this procedural posture is unusual. I think it's probably unprecedented. But it's the most appropriate way that we figured that we could address the issue, let the city move forward with its desalination reactivation. The city did offer, as Dr. Von Langen explained, it did offer to do some additional work. These are not things that we're proposing that the regional board mandate, but we're proposing that the regional board recognize that these are the city's plans in terms of the screens, in terms of the mitigation. And And essentially then what we plan on doing is reporting back to the State Water Board as it continues to consider the Ocean Plan Amendment, whether or not we were able to resolve this issue such that the city could move forward with its facility, and whether or not the State Board should consider any changes to its proposed amendment on this issue. And I do understand this is odd, this is unusual. There are concerns about whether this even makes sense. I want to say that I understand those concerns. I will say, though, that I don't see this as providing much of any kind of a dangerous precedent because of the nature of what we're dealing with here. We're dealing with a statute that is unique in the sense that it's not continuing jurisdiction to change things, as I explained. I think also we've taken a look, and this really is the only, first of all, it's the only facility that objected to the proposed definition, but more importantly, it's the only facility that we know of that fits in this sort of category of being a major portion of a region's long-term water supply portfolio in this sort of drought circumstance, and falling into this sort of odd situation where we frankly were not looking at this issue back in the 90s, and we're looking at it much more closely now.
Thank you. Ms. Cervantes?
Yes, thank you all very much. And my question is, I just have one question, and it has to do with sort of figuring out the timeline of all these various different events regarding the permit application and some of the renewals, and then some of the conversations around the Ocean Plan amendments. But staff made a presentation regarding the renewal permit that came to the board in 2010, and how within that there was already mention about desal discharge. And so I'm wondering, within that permit and then the conversation of the board then, how much was it clear that the city of Santa Barbara would be seeking to reactivate the desal facility? And if that was obvious to the board that that was going to be the intent of the city, why wasn't the city seeking a determination of findings then in 2010? Because I do see in some of the documentation and discussions from the city of Santa Barbara that, you know, it is part of their general plan, part of the plan for their long-term water supply. And so I'm wondering why the conversation about determining the findings and compliance wasn't started then.
I didn't work on that permit, but the city, it's in the permit that they were planning on using this desalination facility as needed for droughts back then, and that preceded the drought.
I can perhaps respond to that. We didn't have a definition in our ocean plan of an expanded facility at that time. So I don't think it was really on the radar of the city or of the regional board staff. It wasn't until after that that we realized that in order to implement that water code section in the ocean plan, we had to define what an expanded facility and what an existing facility and what a new facility is. Sorry, Victoria Whitney, Deputy Director for Water Quality at the State Board.
Thank you. Mr. Young?
Mr. Chair. Mr. Wiles, this is very unique. This is a very unprecedented situation. I don't know that we've had, except for EPA staff joining us when we've had certain permits, I don't think we've had the pleasure of having you or senior State Water Board staff, I'm an assistant director right here. So the whole thing is kind of like a conundrum in a way, you know, trying to make this kind of work out to the best that we can. My initial question to you is, why don't you just exempt the city in the basin plan amendment and just kind of get rid of this? If State Board staff is so comfortable with what has been done before,
a totally fair question, Board Member Young. You know, and frankly, like I said, I don't know what the end result will be with the State Board at when it finally adopts the Ocean Plan Amendment, and I don't know what will happen after that in terms of whether we've satisfied people or there's litigation over it. That's all not knowable today, but I can tell you that I would not be comfortable writing in a single industry or single facility exemption into a, or proposing that the State Board do it into a rulemaking proceeding. Now, it's possible, and a lot of times you'll see the legislature will write laws, general laws, where there is a, you know, fairly obvious but not explicit exemption for certain facilities, and I can't say that that's out of the question. But generally speaking, when we adopt water quality control plans like the Ocean Plan, we try to come up with rules of general application, not specific application.
Okay. What is the timing for the Ocean Plan amendment to be finalized? I mean, is the State Board kind of flexible with when that might happen? I mean, such that, let's say that this board determines, you know what, you know, maybe we're on board with this, but we need to add some additional language requirements. You know, to me, it looks like some of the factors actually were studied and considered. I kind of feel at this point comfortable with that, but I'm going to be asking city staff to explain some of their studies. But maybe if we feel that the mitigation wasn't really addressed, maybe the way we would have addressed it 20 years ago. Let's say that that takes some time for us to do. Is the State Board flexible on its calendar for finalizing this Ocean Plan amendment?
This this project is one of the projects that the State Board members have identified as high priority for the Division of Water Quality staff. We have a number of those projects, about 8 of them. Some of them have been completed. So we are trying to get this done as quickly as we can. Our current schedule calls for the staff to bring it to the board later this spring. The current status is we've had numerous workshops on the desal amendments. We've prepared a CEQA document. It's been out for public comment. It's a substitute environmental document staff report because this is a planning activity. The desal amendments have been out for comment, and we're preparing the responses to comments. The responses to comments on the desal amendment itself are substantially completed and undergoing management and legal review. We're still working on the responses to comments on the CEQA FCD. So it's pretty imminent. We didn't think at the time that we were having the conversations with Santa Barbara last summer and last fall that we were going to have the Ocean Amendment completed prior to the time that they needed to go out for bid on their contracts for their construction in order to get the desal facility operating by next water year, which is what their timeline called for based on their water supply studies. You know, they do have contracts with the State Water Project. I don't know if you guys know this. The State Water Project is oversubscribed in terms of the contracts that it's let, in part because when it was originally conceived, water was supposed to be diverted from the Eel River into the Sacramento River Basin. President Reagan, in his past life, killed that project. And so the Department of Water Resources does not have adequate supplies to fulfill all of its contractual agreements. And folks like Santa Barbara who have contracts for water often don't get the amount of water that they have contracts for, which is one of the factors, as well as the drought, that figures into their water supply portfolio concerns.
Have you noticed the Ocean Plan Amendment agenda item yet?
No.
Okay. So there is a little bit of flexibility there as to which board meeting you actually get it on, right?
I think we heard earlier this morning that we were aiming for April. I think it's fair to say that that's the earliest we could possibly take to the
and
board.
And then, Mr. Wiles, are there other entities similar to Santa Barbara that they didn't object, Santa Barbara did, but are they out there? that are going to fall under this new amendment language and be forced to do studies?
The answer is, I believe, yes. There are some, but and there's a list of approximately 10 in our staff report. And looking through that list, none of them seem to fit the sort of characteristics of the city of Santa Barbara, where it really is a potentially significant amount and needed for a region for water supply reliability. They're much smaller in nature. Monterey Bay Aquarium, for example, is, I believe, in the something like 0.04 million gallons per day for their visitors. Nothing of this sort of scope and nature in terms of regional water supply as this one.
So this is the largest one?
Yes.
Okay. All right. Thank you. Peter?
Could I just ask one
favor
from all of us, is that we have a court recorder, and some of us have a tendency of speaking very fast, and I see you trying some time to really being challenged in taking notes. So if we can just, you know, make sure that we speak a little bit more slowly, that would be appreciated. Thank you.
Okay. You had said that, this is slide 9, that impingement will be eliminated from the use of the weir screen mechanism. And I just wanted to know if you had the information to support that conclusion, or is that something that the city should speak to?
Yes. Recent studies that were done by Tenera up at the Santa Cruz pilot desal plant, where they did impingement studies on a 7 million gallon a day intake, showed no impingement from using a pilot project there. And they documented it with camera footage and by other studies. Mm-hmm.
And this is based on the same anticipated intake flow that Santa Barbara would be?
It's approximately the same. It's 7 million gallons a day intake at the Santa Cruz project, about 20 million gallons a day at the Santa Barbara project, so comparable. And the intake velocities were comparable, too. The intake velocity of the Santa Barbara is proposed to be less than 0.1 feet per second, which is even dramatically slower than the proposed statewide policy and for the Federal Clean Water Act 316B rules for power plants of 0.5 feet per second.
Did those studies also look at entrainment?
Yes, the Santa Cruz pilot project looked at entrainment as well.
And what was the mesh size of those weirs?
I believe they used, it was either 1 or 2 millimeter intake mesh offhand. And so the proposed project here is 1 millimeter or less, so it's more protective than the one that was used in Santa Cruz, or equal.
And then I think you just said that they did look at entrainment.
Yes.
And that study up there, what were the conclusions on entrainment?
The conclusions that the most entrained species is a white croaker, which is a sandy bottom fish, and it would be expected that would be the most entrained species around here as well. And yearly entrainment of larvae were found to be less than 0.06% of the source water body of the area around the intake pipe. And it was basically scaled up to make the equivalent of the same amount of larvae were entrained as one white croaker adult female would have as offspring in her lifetime. So one fish is the most adult fish equivalent.
One adult fish, that was the equivalent. Of course, the entrainment study is just simply looking at larvae and eggs.
Yes.
Right, because that's all that can get through a 1 millimeter mesh.
Yes.
Okay. Do you have the other subsection to the statute? It's subsection D. Can you put that on the screen?
I don't have a slide of that.
Because I'd like to explore that. I think that's part of this discussion.
Harvey's working on getting the water code section up there.
I mean, it's the one that basically says that there should be some baseline studies done to assess environmental loss.
Mr. Young, would you like me to read it into the record? Would that be helpful?
What's that?
Harvey's going to bring it up, too.
We have it handy.
Subsection D is in David.
I can read it into the record if you'd like.
Well, we have an Elmo projector here. I think it helps the public if we can display this so we all know what we're talking about.
We're using 1991 technology with this cable.
Why don't you go ahead and propose to read it first?
While they're setting up, do you have perhaps another question, Mr. Young?
I do, and so what I want to get into is that I see from reading the source documents that were provided by staff that the city did do oceanographic studies back in 88, 89.
Oops.
And and that the only study that they have relied upon to assess any kind of loss to marine life was the Ormond Beach study. And it looks to me like the statute that I'm asking you to put up on the Elmo requires that a site-specific study be done to assess loss of marine life. Just wanted to get staff's reaction to that.
I reviewed the work that was done in 1991 and the 1994 EIRs that looked at the site assessments of the area, and the plankton studies that were done down in Ormond Beach were similar types of plankton concentrations that you would expect to find around here. And I think that the consultant of the city would be better to explain some of the details of that. But overall, there was a lot of work at the old outfall and intake location of the benthic infauna and epifauna and other work that was done in the region.
All right. I know that that's what they relied upon, and I what I'm trying to get at is, shouldn't we be looking at something specific to the site? I think that's what the statute speaks to. And so, I mean, Ormond Beach is down in Ventura. It's not here. I didn't see any of the results of the actual study. I just saw conclusions put in the staff report. And so, you know, if we had been doing this 20 years ago, we would be asking these questions about, okay, what really was studied? What are the results? What were the impacts? I mean, what I got back from my comments to staff was a list of species that were probably impinged and trained, but I'd like more information about those in terms of percentages and identifying which ones are offshore species versus intertidal species. And
they didn't do an entrainment study back in those days.
Okay. All right.
Back in the early 1990s,
what kind of study was it?
It was an assessment of how much plankton and larvae would have been taken in, but it was plankton toes, basically, given concentrations.
What I thought. Yeah. So it's a different kind of a study. Someone went out in a boat with a plankton net and did some toes, and then looked at what was in the toes. Was it done monthly, over a year period? Was it done one time?
Hi, Megan Powers, State Water Board. I read the study, and it's a pretty basic oceanographic study, and they did zooplankton toes over 3 years, from 1982 to 1984, and they were able to capture seasonal variability and also captured an El Nino event. It was a pretty standard procedure using pretty standard volumetric net toes. And from, drawing on my own knowledge of zooplankton, I would expect that even if it's 40 miles down the coast, I would expect that very similar assemblages and species of plankton would also exist in Santa Barbara. But they did not do this. The study was done at Ormond Beach offshore. So, and they did transects, so they did four different stations along the Southern California Bight.
And so, and you mentioned it was over a three-year period?
Yeah, from 1982 to 1984.
How frequently during each year did they do these studies? And I mean, I ask these questions because plankton and larvae vary through the year. There are periods of time when you've got
zooplankton. Sure, and it definitely depends on nutrients and different things, of course. So they also did, in the same study, they also did studies on nutrients and looking at different, you know, trying to understand why zooplankton volume was different in one area or why it was spiked in some years and not the others. They did about four sampling events, four or five sampling events each year.
Each year, so they kind of did it quarterly.
Sort of, yeah.
Yeah, so about 12 events over the course of the three-year study.
Roughly, yeah.
Okay.
I would say.
All right.
These are all of the four different sites that they did down the California Bight.
Okay. So why is the city voluntarily offering to do anything if there's going to be no impingement? And it looks like the entrainment then is negligible from what we're being told. Why offer to do anything?
You mean why offer to...
To do any mitigation.
Mitigation.
City is environmentally conscious, and they can probably speak to it more than I can.
Okay. So... In the plankton TOAs that were done, the plankton studies over the three-year period. So, what was the percentage of offshore species versus inshore estuarine?
They didn't look at that. They looked at just volumetric. Oh.
Well, even by volume, if they looked at species, they would know where, just by identification, where the species habitats are.
Yeah, most of these, so this was done offshore, so a lot of these areas were oceanographic, like pelagic-type plankton species, not benthic.
Okay.
So they were done an oblique tow, so where they throw the net in the water and then very deep, and then they tow it back up to the surface.
Okay. So what the city's proposing $500,000 towards the Devereaux project.
Yeah.
Now, wouldn't that primarily just help estuarine species?
Yeah,
intertidal species, and it would not benefit offshore species?
I think there are some species that probably, there's larvae, fish larvae, that take refuge in wetland areas. I don't think it would be a direct comparison to oceanographic species, but I think it's really difficult to have in-kind mitigation. So having, you know, how to actually create an oceanographic pelagic environment and how to recreate that environment someplace else. So I think one of the best options is to do wetlands kind of recovery, in my opinion, just because it will also offer habitat for other intertidal species that live in the area.
So what you're saying is that there's a loss of offshore species that we just don't have a good tool for mitigating.
I would say that, yeah.
And all we can do is to help intertidal benthic species.
Yeah. I would say that. Okay. It's very difficult to mitigate for those kinds of open ocean environments.
Okay. An infiltration gallery, is that the same as the subsurface intake?
That's a technical question.
Because I'm lost after
they
Mr.
Are,
Johnson kind of asked
it. It is one, Victoria Whitney, State Water Board, it is one kind of subsurface intake. You can have horizontal wells, slant wells, infiltration galleries. An infiltration gallery, if you wanted to visualize it, is where you go in and you basically dig up the ocean bottom and you put in a square, rectangular series of filters, and then you put all the pipes underneath, and then you put the ocean bottom materials back on top of it, and the ocean bottom acts as a filter as the water's being pulled in. We have an engineering design firm that's working with the city representative here, and I expect he can answer your questions about the technologies.
Helps me. So it's more like a big, a squared out area that's dug up and a matrix is put down. instead yes. of a subsurface intake the way we're now thinking of. It's more like a intake line buried in the sand with ports in it.
So Monterey is looking at a series of slant wells, which are just exactly what they sound like. They're wells that you drill at an angle. Infiltration galleries used in Japan. There's one facility there, a fairly sizable one, although not as big as the one that's being proposed at Carlsbad, for instance, that uses infiltration galleries. So there are different technologies that you use, and which one you pick, you know, it depends on the circumstances of the site and how much water you need to intake, et cetera.
Okay, so you have the statute up there, D, sub D. So does staff feel that we don't need to comply with that section, or
can that be read, Jeff? I can't see it. Can it be read, section D?
Subsection D. Can you guys use your pointers or there?
I can read it out. It says, independent baseline studies of the existing marine system should be conducted in the area that could be affected by a new or expanded industrial facility using seawater in advance of the carrying out of the development.
So it's a should, not a shall, but it does contemplate some kind of independent study being done at the site. And so my concern is whether that has been done or not, or whether it should be done.
So if I can, Mr. Young.
Yes.
The proposed ocean plan amendment actually does, as I was explaining, require an analysis of any proposed new facility. And a lot of that analysis actually does require the collection of baseline data. And so certainly we are using that same concept in subdivision D to support the requirements that new facility proponents actually go out and study things. In some cases, we had proposed up to 3 years of independent of baseline studies. I think that may change, but we're certainly having some areas where the current proposal is for at least a year worth of study prior to conducting the analysis of the data to determine whether that facility will meet the site design technology and mitigation that's best feasible for here. I think, you know, my view is that certainly this section was, the subdivision was in existence back in the early 90s. I think what I heard from Dr. Powers is that the type of baseline studies that were conducted at that time may have been somewhat different than the types of studies that we would be requiring if we were requiring a study today. But certainly, I think I agree with the premise that ideally, those studies would have been undertaken back in the 90s to support the proposal for this desalination facility. And it sounds like some studies were done, but and I think that was the sort of your questions about the type of studies that were done. And,
I mean, I would think that we would have done something. I mean, looking back 20 years, we didn't have this mindset on, so we didn't have that filter on. We weren't thinking of entrainment impingement. So how could we be thinking about what would be an applicable study to comply with the section?
I think, frankly, as Appendix G tries to explain, we are, in large part, suggesting that we use what we think were our, you know, current standards for studies, for site design, mitigation, everything, what we think those were back in the early 90s to see whether or not today the board can decide that, yeah, this project actually did satisfy what we think were the standards back then. And as you said, it's a bit of a conundrum.
Right. Now, what currently is the State Board contemplating in its policy in terms of compliance with subsection D? In other words, I'm kind of curious, without having, you know, the intake in place doing its, you know, take on species, right, how do you ever get a baseline study? You know, because I don't know that plankton towing going around in the channel or in the ocean necessarily tells you exactly what's going to be impinged or entrained. And maybe it does, but that would be my question. So
if you give me a moment, I can point to you or read to you the sections where we do require these baseline studies in the proposed ocean plan amendment. Maybe Victoria will help me here.
Actually, I want to augment what Phil's looking for. We have three places where we require studies. In two of those places, the studies are required only if somebody is proposing alternative technologies. So we've set up preferences in the ocean plan amendment for subsurface intakes, but there's an out, if you will, where a subsurface intake isn't feasible, and it's where people are proposing something other than a subsurface intake that we're requiring these studies. And the same thing goes for discharges. We have a preference for high-pressure diffusers as the discharge technology. And if somebody wants to use something other than that, then they have to do studies to show that the discharges will achieve the same levels of environmental protection that the pressure diffusers would achieve. And so it isn't a situation where, and the reason we wrote it that way is because we recognize that some of these facilities are very small, some of the communities may be cash-strapped, and based on the information that we had available to us, which was developed in part by three expert panels that we've convened over the last few years, it looked like the subsurface technologies were the better technologies if they were feasible. And we didn't see any point in making folks go through and do the high levels of studies if they were going to conclude that they were going to put in a subsurface intake anyway. They'll obviously have to do some studies to determine whether or not subsurface intakes are feasible for other reasons. It's much harder, for instance, to put a subsurface intake in a rocky outcrop than it is in, you know, a sandy bottom kind of situation. But they're not required in every situation by our policy, simply because we're relying on the work that and the advice that was given to us by the expert panels that we had convened.
So if someone in the future proposes to do a subsurface intake, would they not have to do any baseline studies?
They would, I believe. Let me just kind of read to you, if I can, the general provisions for baseline studies in the proposed amendment. Again, emphasizing this is proposed, it's not adopted yet. There's a general provision that says that the regional board, consulting with state water board staff, and the assumption there is that there's some additional ocean expertise at the state board, can require the owner or operator for one of these newer expanded facilities to provide any additional studies or information as needed, subject to the approval of the regional water board. The main study is for mitigation, and the provision, the proposed provision there is that that the owner or operator submit a report to the regional water board, and I'm sorry, I'll speak slower, to the regional water board, projecting the marine life mortality resulting from construction and operation of the facility, and that report shall include a detailed entrainment study. The entrainment study period shall be at least 36 consecutive months. Sampling shall be designed to account for variation in oceanographic conditions and larval abundance and diversity, such that abundance estimates are reasonably accurate. So that's a three-year baseline study in terms of what the impacts will be for the purposes of figuring out what kind of mitigation is necessary to deal with those impacts. And Vicki wants me to emphasize again, that's the current staff proposal. That may change, but it's consistent with the notion in subdivision D that we do want to require going forward that at least new facilities or expansions of facilities, that they do these baseline studies, and we would hold them to what we believe today is the right way to do those studies.
Okay. Thank you. I don't have any more questions, Dr. Wolf.
Thank you. Dr. Hunter?
Thank you. I'm going to pursue just a little bit
further some of the issues raised by Mr. Young. So, Peter, in your presentation, I noted that in part the determination that there was insignificant impact associated with the current design of this facility in part is related to the fact that there are high larval populations known for that area. And I agree with that statement to the extent that we saw a very extended process associated with identifying highly productive fishery areas associated with the Marine Protection Act and the establishment of marine protected areas. And the Santa Barbara Channel area in particular underwent, in addition to that, the Channel Islands National Marine Sanctuary conducted its 20-year, rather than 5 years, 20-year review of its management plan and established a number of marine protected areas based on the value of the channel for fishery production. So again, getting to what Mr. Wiles just mentioned, that a baseline study would incorporate specific diversity of oceanographic and ocean populations. So I have the same problem that Mr. Young has raised in looking, for example, at Santa Cruz, which is not necessarily, in my view, in my understanding, and in following the MPA process, as considered as a highly productive and valued for its commercial fishery potential. So I think that the assumption that there's a higher larval population and therefore there's an insignificant impact, somehow we have extra population there that we can just consider insignificant. I think it's just the opposite. If we have a high larval population and you were to actually do the studies required, or you would find information that could give us some idea of what is the density of the larval population in that specific area, then we might see that the entrainment is actually significant because it is a high and rich and diverse ocean environment. And so by association with the state's study of its marine resources, we may find that there are studies that have been done that could contribute to our understanding of what is the potential significant impact from entrainment. So that would be one issue. And I'm not going to ask Peter, I don't need to have you respond, because I think you did respond to Mr. Young in that way, but I just want to reiterate that. I just don't see that the studies that we're relying on, and I heard the word assumption being used a number of times to say that we assume that because this study showed us a low impact, that a study, that the same type of impact based on the design of the system, not based on the oceanographic conditions and seasonal as raised by Mr. Young. The second issue I have, and maybe this is for Mr. Wiles, concerns the issue of expansion. And my question is something that I haven't heard addressed, and that regards the original permit that was issued, and I've seen this in several ways, but I have not found it in the permit itself. I have to say that I'm going to rely on staff there. If the original permit was issued for a temporary facility, and now the city is shifting in considering this facility as part of its permanent water portfolio, would that be considered an expansion? Because I'll give you two things that made me raise this question. In this flyer, on the last page, under the heading, is the desalination plant a regional facility? In the first line, it reads, when the temporary desalination plant was constructed in 1991. So the city is referring there to the temporary desalination plant. In the next section, it says, what would be the alternative if the desalination plant is not reactivated? And in the second line, it says that the program includes the conversion of the temporary emergency facility to a permanent part of our water supply, and that this has been approved by the city's planning commission, the California Coastal Commission, and the city's El Estero wastewater treatment plant discharge permit. So now we're talking about going from something that was considered temporary to something that was considered, to something we can now regard as permanent. I also want to bring into this a point that I'm raising in attachment 4, in response to comments. Response number 9, the staff also, or I'm not sure who completed this document, if this was a combination of regional board staff with state water board staff, I don't know. But this also refers to the city, I think, towards the bottom of paragraph 9 response. Quote, furthermore, the city currently does not intend to operate this facility continuously. So you've got staff commenting on the fact that it's a temporary facility. You have the original permit, I believe, would show that it was a temporary facility as described by the city itself. And then you have the statement in this flyer that this now is going to become part of the city's permanent water portfolio. So is that an expansion under the definition?
So let me try to answer that a couple of different ways. First of all, let me acknowledge that that Victoria and I did work with your staff to help both draft the proposal for attachment G and helped look through the comments and draft the responses to comments. And we had a difficult time, frankly, trying to understand the history of this project. And I think we got it right, but certainly we should confirm with the city that we got it right. In both the first paragraph of attachment G and also in response number 9 to the channel keeper's question, what we say is that it was originally permitted as a temporary facility. That was, I believe, in 1991, and our temporary operation of the facility was the original permit, and then in 1996, it was permitted for permanent operation. Now, all along, though, it has, I believe, been intended to be used only intermittently, and I want to distinguish intermittent from temporary. And I believe the city will tell us today that that is still their intent, is to only operate this desalination facility intermittently when their water needs get to the point where they have to operate. But again, let's confirm that with the city. Now, your question is, does that constitute an expansion? And I will tell you that if the state board does adopt the amendment to the ocean plan as currently drafted, let me do the easy one first, which is, what if it were a new facility that someone was dreaming up today and coming to the regional board for approval today? The answer is it would depend on what the regional board actually analyzed when it did this water code 13142.5B. Wow, I used to be able to do that all the time. 13142.5B determination. If the analysis assumed and took into account some type of operation that was intermittent, and certainly we would talk about how many gallons per day would be taken in through the intakes, and the project proponent later, after that determination was concluded, decided to increase the amount of time that the facility was operated or decided to bring in more water when it was operating, then the Ocean Plan Amendment would certainly consider that to be an expansion and would require a new 13142.5B determination prior to initiating that expansion. How that applies to this facility, frankly, I think the way that I'm viewing it is that I think we got it right in terms of the analysis, and I think that the information in the record does support viewing this as not an expansion from what was originally contemplated in the early 1990s. But it's absolutely a good question. And if I can, while I have the microphone, the issue about marine protected areas, I just wanted to point out that that is certainly an issue for us. Now, not so much in terms of what the how to calculate the mortality from entrainment, but the current draft Ocean Plan Amendment does have a specific provision dealing with MPAs. So our current thinking, anyway, is that the language reflects this, that the intake structures cannot be located within an MPA, and the discharges must be located sufficiently far from an MPA so that there would be no impact from the discharge on the MPA. So certainly today, we are focused on protecting those areas.
Thank you, Dr. Hunter. And most of my questions I'm going to hold off until I hear the presentation from the city. But, you know, one question I have, and it's somewhat a peripheral question relating to jurisdictional authority. Does the Coastal Commission has any input on this in terms of, you know, what's happening to the pipe, the discharge, the location, the change of application, the screen, et cetera?
I can answer that briefly. The city can do a better job with the details, but the Coastal Commission had first permitted this also back in the 90s, and it's considered an existing facility with the Coastal Commission, but there is a maintenance permit required for the intake structure changes, is my understanding at this point.
Okay, and I'll ask a few more questions to the city, actually, on the topic of maintenance of a system. Without duplicating questions from my colleagues, I still struggle with the insignificant impact. I realize insignificant is not the same as non-existent, but if the state is looking at subsurface technologies, and Ms. Whitman gave a brief introduction of the different technologies contemplated, that to me is implicit that there is an impact when you have the type of technology that is currently proposed. So I'm still struggling with that aspect. In regard to the Devereux Slough project, and perhaps this is a better question for the city, but why that site? Has there been a robust analysis of looking at what other potential mitigation sites could have been chosen?
I can speak to that a little bit. The amount of, the restoration project and the fee was based on a review of like a need of support of different projects within the Santa Barbara region. And staff identified the Upper Devereux Slough project with the Southern California Wetlands Recovery Project. So we looked at different projects within the area with the city and basically made a determination about that project based on its scale, need for funding, and its location. So the scale is such that hopefully the amount that the city is providing to the project will mitigate past the impact that desalination will be operational, we hope. And the restoration project we found suitable because it'll help restore wetlands within a general area of the source water body, so it's 10 miles up the coast by the UCSB campus. So it's not directly, so the larvae and things that will be hopefully protected and restored in this area won't become entrained from the intake system that's further down, down the area, down in the desalination intake. So that's kind of the basis for how we kind of came up with the Upper Dover Slough project.
Thank you. And then last question for now that I have is for Dr. Von Langen. And we talked about well test that had been done many years ago and the fact that the yield was insufficient to meet the expected amount of daily gallonage needed. But I'm not too clear on how extensive the site study was done. Did it pick one location, say, okay, let's see what happens there, or was there a very good detailed study looking at various locations and actually performing some of the exploratory wells at various locations, or it became site-specific and no other locations were being contemplated or actually tested?
There were several studies. And the first study was approximately a mile of beach where I think they did nine wells.
Could you repeat that?
Sorry. There were several studies. I believe the first study was approximately 1 mile along the beach looking at beach wells. And based on the hydraulic conductivity there, they reckoned it would take 100 to 200 wells, and that wouldn't be enough to get the 3,000 plus acre feet that they were looking at originally. And then subsequently to that, when they decided to get a bigger intake project just after they did the study, it wouldn't be suitable for that as well.
Yeah, but that means just one location. I mean, it's almost the analogy of when you perform perk test, for septic systems. Usually you don't rely, you just don't pick one location, say, well, that didn't work, and you use often other locations as well. So if I understand you correctly, there was really only one location where these tests were performed, and physically there was no other locations where these tests were being performed. Do you understand this correctly?
I recall that further studies looked up and down at other locations along East Beach and closer to Stearns Wharf, and I think the city's consultant, Joe Monica, can go into much more detail of specifics regarding the location.
So I will hold off further asking question on that topic until we have a chance to hear from the city. And I see motions from my colleagues here. What I'd like to propose is, unless there is a real key question that you have still, we will take our break after these series of questions that we had to staff, and then we'll reconvene after that with the city. So Did you have one?
I think it's kind of key to me, of course. Everyone's question is kind of key to them, but I think that this might kind of help us frame how we're going to be analyzing this. If I could just quickly get my question out and our attorneys can answer this. I shouldn't be looking at you, Mr. Wiles, but Tamara. So, we're being asked to look back in time 20 years. But and to make these findings now as though they were made then, to have them apply to then, would it be just as appropriate for us to have, upon the five-year renewal for this NPDES permit, every time it came up for renewal, that we renewed it, would it have been appropriate at those five-year increments to have also gone through this process, but then looked at the current technology at that point in time? So if it was done in 1991 and 1996 and then in 2001, could we have done this and just looked at what we had technology-wise?
We're playing Monday morning quarterback, aren't we? And so the issue on the code section is dealing with is the new and expanded language. And okay. So that's why we go to 1991. So conceivably, in the abstract, could we have made these findings at any point in time? Yes, we could have. And really, it boils down to the reason that we didn't is, I think, as Mr. Wiles explained earlier, having to do with the more recent litigation and this becoming to the coming to the fore as an issue pertaining to desalinization plants and not just cooling facilities. So yes, in the abstract, we could have, but the reason that we look back today to 1991 as opposed to another cycle of the permit is that's when the facility was new.
Okay, fair enough.
For water state staff. Up in Monterey, the State Water Resource Control Board has told California American Water to prove that slant well technology is infeasible before going ahead with open intake. So my question is, if we're seeing today some studies showing that the, or not studies, but the recommendation is that open intake mortality to due to entrainment is so minimal, then why would the State Water Resource Control Board, you know, make CalAmp spend $5 million on basically a feasibility study of slant well technology?
So let me, so the CalAmp project, for better or worse, we're looking at that at the beginning of the project, not, you know, in hindsight 20 years later. And so my assumption is that what you're referring to is that it would be considered a new facility under the Ocean Plan Amendment, as long as the state board adopts this amendment sometime relatively soon.
Right, but I'm trying to get to, and I'm sorry for interrupting you, but I didn't want to go to where you're going for this. This insignificant impact to larvae, right. If it's insignificant here, then why have a preference or why designate subsurface intake as environmentally preferable if it's insignificant?
Sure.
Victoria Whitney, State Water Board, Deputy Director for Water Quality. I don't think that you can conclude that the impact is insignificant all along the coast. Monterey is proposing to put their intakes in a national marine sanctuary, for one thing, that is highly productive and has a lot of ocean life. The expert panel that we convened on intake issues concluded that you can't, whatever you do, except for subsurface technologies, because again, you're using the ocean floor as a screen, you can't mitigate for 100% of the impacts from the open water intakes, which is why they recommend the EPM ATF. Let me get this right.
Yeah.
ETM APF methodology for determining what the responsibility of the desal facility should be in terms of mitigation. And one of the things that we've been struggling with is the same thing that you addressed earlier, Mr. Young, which is that you in-kind mitigation seems to be pretty much impossible in certain circumstances. If the intake is to reef species, you can put a reef in, but if it's to sandy bottom habitat, you know, nature determines where the sandy bottom habitat exists, and the forces of the ocean have more impact on that than a mitigation project that we could conceive of, at least at this time. So we are having discussions with our board members about whether they want to continue to propose in-kind mitigation in the ocean plan. That's something that might change just based with the realities of the situation. But I think that it is incorrect to assume that it's insignificant everywhere. It is site-specific.
Board Member Delgado, I'm sorry, if I could just add a little bit to that. The approach that we're taking in the current Ocean Plan proposed amendment is not based on levels of significance in terms of impact. We're reading the statute now to say essentially that the project proponents need to use the best feasible site design and technology available to minimize mortality. And we are then saying, once you've done that, under the proposed amendment, we want you to go out and essentially do mitigation that will replace the remaining marine life that does die. So we're not taking the position that we're only going to require mitigation for significant impacts. We're actually trying to create an approach under this section today that requires minimizing mortality, site design technology, and then applying mitigation to take care of all of the remaining impacts. The point that we were trying to make in the Appendix G is that that is not an approach that was in vogue in the early 90s. In the early 90s, mitigation really was conceived as of not using 13142.5 generally, but using CEQA generally. You only mitigate for significant impacts. And that's the distinction between, I think, what we project would have been the sort of the analysis in the 90s versus what we're proposing that the State Board adopt as a rule for how we do that analysis going forward.
So thank you, Ms. Whitney and Mr. Weichmann, for your assistance. I think at this time, it is appropriate to take a lunch break. We will have a closed session, so we do need an hour. We would have tried to reduce it a little bit, but we'll need an hour. The good news, however, is that the rest of the afternoon is pretty much dedicated to this item, so we will have ample time.
Yes, and with that, Mr. Chair, a couple announcements. So item number 10 is going to be pulled from the agenda due to illness. The enforcement report we can push till tomorrow, and then item 12, which is closed session, we'll deal with during lunch. So you are correct. We have the rest of the afternoon for this item.
Thank you. So we will reconvene in
Mr.
1 hour.
Mr. Chair, also, Ms. Austin has to make a statement on the record.
Right, just announcing that we will be meeting in closed session pursuant to Government Code Section 11126E2A regarding items 13 and 14 on the agenda. Thank you.
Thank you.